Tonight to the Gospel of John, chapter 13, verse 30. Yes, we're still in Luke, but I need a verse to lead us in to what we're looking at tonight. And this one does it. Tonight we're going to look at the betrayal of Jesus in Luke 22, verses 47 through 53. And I've tried to make this lesson of a length that will allow at the end for us to practice making some observations. I've said that 7 or 8 times, I think, and I always take up the whole hour. I hope I planned it tonight so we'll have some time at the end for you to practice on making observations. Observation simply means, what did you see? And can you prove to someone else that what you saw was really what you saw? And so we'll end tonight with, what did you see? As we went through this context, and we want to be looking very carefully at Luke 22, 47 through 53 for everything that we can see that is there, and then we'll record some of the things that we have seen at the end. I've had you go to John chapter 13 because this picks us up historically on the final night. Passover has been eaten, and the Lord has given the sop to Judas, and the betrayal begins. Most of Jesus' remarks about the betrayal use a present tense and emphasize that the betrayal is now in progress and going on. He does not say, I have been betrayed, as though it were simply an act. It's the whole process of betrayal, and in chapter 19, verse 30, the betrayal begins to come into effect. Now, of course, the arrangements were made beforehand, the money was passed beforehand, but now the actual thing. And so in the midst of the Passover feast, we have verse 30 of John 13. And so, after receiving the morsel, he, Judas, went out immediately, and it was night. And so if you can now picture his leaving the upper room, and now go to Luke chapter 22, and we'll look at the betrayal. 22:47-53. A couple of things, this among them, for introduction to the betrayal. And first is, as we've already said, John chapter 13 and verse 30 picks up with Judas leaving the room. And the important thing about that is Judas has a lot to do. When it says he went out immediately, that means he went out in a hurry. He had to hurry for several reasons. And so let's note, so we'll get the hustle and the bustle. Quick action was required for the following reasons. In the first place, what would be an obvious reason why Judas had to really hustle? What were the crowds that had greeted Jesus at the triumphal entry? What were they doing right now? What do you do at night? They were not cruising, they were sleeping. So the crowds. And remember, those crowds had been so sympathetic that the Jewish leaders knew that if we move against Jesus, they'll kill us. And so Judas is saying, look, I've got to move, and I've got to move quickly. So the crowds that were sympathetic were asleep. Next time, we will go through item by item by item by item how everything in the trials of Jesus was illegal. There were more illegal things done in the trial of Christ than you can find with any other event recorded in the Bible. It was just a pile of illegalities one after another. And when it says it was night and they began these proceedings, right off front, there's the first one. Because it was illegal for these proceedings to go on at night. But again, Judas leaves. Immediately, he hurries out of the room. The crowds are asleep. And therefore, he must act while that is the case. Several things had to be done. Jesus had to be located. Now you say, well, couldn't Judas just bring them back where he left them? No. Because as Judas goes out to get the people who are going to be going to arrest Jesus, the disciples leave the upper room. And Judas wasn't for sure. We know we've got to find him. So Jesus had to be identified. A posse had to be organized. All of this at night. There were the Roman soldiers. There were the temple police. So the posse had to be organized. The temple police had to be notified. And there was no way that the Jewish people could simply call upon the Roman soldiers. They had to get permission. So, a detachment of Roman soldiers had to be obtained. The figure holds, the Roman soldiers were detached in a cohort, that's 600 men. If that figure holds. Since the Sanhedrin was not a part of it, all members of the Sanhedrin had to be notified. All members had to be notified. Before anything could be done, the chief honcho had to be informed. Ananias. Or not Ananias, Annas, A-N-N-A-S, had to be notified. Basically, he was not the high priest at the time, but nothing went through without the permission of Annas. They also had to gather their equipment. We were told that they had lanterns. That's always been a puzzle. It was a date-wise, Passover is full moon. But they had to have lanterns. They got swords. They got clubs. Clubs would be like a police officer's nightstick. Had to be collected. And in all of this, only those in on it could know. Had to be a lot of secrets, see. Only those on in it could know. Now you think of all of those things that had to be done. Judas leaves the room, and he's got to hustle. I can't let the crowds know what we're about to do. It's got to be over by the time they begin to rise in the morning. We've got to have them over into Roman hands. We've got to figure out where Jesus would go. Probably Judas thought he would hide. That would be normal and natural. But he has to be located. They've got to get the posse together to come after the Lord. They've got to notify the temple police. They've got to get permission from Rome to get a detachment of Roman soldiers. All the members of the Sanhedrin had to be notified. Remember, by courier, too. I mean, they didn't say, you know, if you got a list of the Sanhedrin's telephone numbers. Had to go from house to house. There was a lot of hustling going on at that night. Annas, you can't move without him. Probably had to get him out of bed and notify what was going on. They had to gather the equipments, the lanterns, the swords, the clubs, and we got to keep all of this quiet. And therefore, probably Judas had maybe 7 hours to get the whole thing pulled together. So again, he left that room immediately. Means he was in a hurry and needed to be in a hurry in order to pull all of this together. Now, in Luke 22:47. Here they come. 22:47 is where we pick up. And we will break this down into several parts, very simply. Number one, we will focus about the kiss of Judas. And the kiss is the focal point, verses 47 and 48. So verse 47 now, it's all pulled together. Judas has been doing his hustling. He is in the garden, Jesus is, and he is now coming out of the garden. And in verse 47, while he was still speaking, behold, a crowd came. And the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him. So that the crowd would have been something like this. And let me give what the order would have been. And I put this together not only from Luke, but from Matthew, Mark, and John also. Picture the crowd coming, and don't make it simply a picture, but picture it as Judas in the lead. So whatever you picture, you've got to have Judas probably with his lantern, with his torch, out in front of everybody else. Along with him and associated next with Judas is Malchus, the high priest, servant of the high priest. With him would be associated a group of temple police. With the temple police, to back them would be your Roman backup. Following them, you had, notice in verse 52, it says, Jesus said to the chief priests, officers of the temple, and elders. Those were all representatives of the Sanhedrin. So the high court representatives. And that makes up your crowd. Judas leading, Malchus, the servant of the high priest, coming next, followed by the temple police, supported by the Roman backup, perhaps as many as 600. And then you have representatives of the Sanhedrin that are up near enough to the front that they can talk and convince with Judas. Now, notice that Luke has the following stress. His stress is not on the act of betrayal. His stress is on the response of Jesus to the kiss. His stress is the response of Jesus to the kiss. Verse 48. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? And so notice his emphasis is not, this was a kiss of betrayal. He says, Judas, what are you doing? Now what do you think that was intended to be? Judas, what are you doing? Sometimes one of the best methods of Bible study is to take a verse and change the words and then ask yourself, why didn't he say it that way? Verse 48, let me change the words, and when I change the words, then we'll have to answer, why didn't he use the word that I changed it to? Can you change the words in verse 48? Judas, are you betraying me with a kiss? Now, obviously, he did not say that and didn't mean that. But in one sense, doesn't that make lots of... Isn't that what he's asking Judas? Judas, did you betray me with a kiss? In other words, notice in the response of Jesus, he did not say, you're betraying me. But you're betraying the Son of Man. Now, what is the difference between me saying me and Son of Man? Both of them referred to Jesus. The difference is this. Son of Man was his own term or his own claim to be the Messiah. So the issue then is, Judas, think for just a moment. You're not just betraying me. You're not just betraying a man. You're betraying the Messiah. And he puts it in the form of a question and says, think about it. Wouldn't you say that the Lord has given Judas an opportunity? Think what you're doing. Ponder on who I am. You may not like me, Judas, but how do you feel about the Son of Man? The title Son of Man comes out of Daniel 7. Let's flip back to it. Daniel 7. And when you read Daniel 7, you get some of the weight of what is meant by the word Son of Man. In chapter 7, verse 13, Son of Man, would it not, if you just take it all by itself, simply mean human? Son of God means divine. Son of Man means human. But notice the usage of the word won't let us make it say just human, because its use is rooted in the Old Testament. 7:13, Daniel says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him, that is the Son of Man, was given dominion, glory, kingdom, that all people, nations, and men of every language might serve him. Think about it, Judas. Who are you betraying? You're betraying the one that has all dominion and glory and kingdom, the one that every nation is to serve. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not destroy. Do you want to do this, Judas? And so taking it back then to Luke, the focus then is on who you are betraying. And the question says, do you want to change? So you have an extension, I believe, of grace to Judas. Now, the kiss itself was simply a sign of friendship. Affection. It had nothing to do with romance. I remember when, David, maybe you remember this, when we were in Amman, Jordan, we went walking in Amman in the evening, and I remember how horrified you were that men held hands, and thoughts about men holding hands. But that's the way men do in Jordan. Men hold hands, and it just simply means friendship. I think it's yucky, but nonetheless, it is a sign of friendship for men to hold hands. For Judas, it wasn't a sign of friendship. It was the key to the betrayal. For Judas, it was a sign of identification. And the picture, as soon as I show you what the picture is, you'll get it immediately. Because when you see Judas come up and kiss him in betrayal, you're not talking about coming up and, as men will often do in Europe, kiss on one cheek and then the other, and in some cultures back to the other, which is a handshake. It's a greeting. The picture of Judas kissing Jesus is, well, let me show you. And I'll let you form your own picture. Look at Mark 14:15. It's more than just a identification that betrays the Lord. It was a mocking kind of kiss. Now, for you that are interested in such things and want this kind of information, the normal word for kiss in Greek is phileo. And I'm putting this here for a reason now. Phileo. To be a friend or to kiss. Phileo was the kiss. The word that Mark picks up, and he saw something, he didn't want us to picture Judas simply going up and giving Jesus a peck on the cheek. Judas did not give Jesus a peck on the cheek. He did not just phileo him. The word that Mark uses, and if you come down to chapter 14, verse 45, and after coming, he immediately went to him, saying, Rabbi, and kissed him. And the interesting thing is that the word phileo here looks like this. It is kata phileo. And kata phileo also means to kiss, but it is the intensive form. The intensive form. You could take that with the following ideas. The intensive form implies repetition. It involves intensity or passion. And it can also convey the idea of all over. So Judas kissed Jesus passionately, repeatedly, all over. And you can picture the scene. It's sick, isn't it? Horrible betrayal on the part of Judas. So don't ever again think of a peck on the cheek. It was more than that. He betrayed him good. He betrayed him fully. And he identified him so that nobody could miss. And he kissed him over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And this was the part of the betrayal, the little extra color that Mark gives. So let's go back to Luke. Now, remember that the kiss was given in order to identify Jesus. So let's note this also. The kiss was unnecessary. It was unneeded. And the reason we say it was unnecessary is because of John chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. John 18, 3 and 4 shows why it was unnecessary. The point was, we want to be sure to get the right person, and consequently, the kiss identified the right person. But that wasn't needed at all. Here's why it was not needed, because if you read in John chapter 18, verse 3, Judas then, having received the Roman cohort, notice having received, he had to go and ask for it. That was part of his hurry that night. Judas, who was betraying him, verse 3. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort, and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things that were coming on him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" So there was no need for Judas to kiss Jesus at all. Jesus stepped forward and said, "Who are you looking for?" And they answered, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas, who was betraying him, was standing with them. So notice before, and Judas at that point must have said, "I don't get to do what I wanted to do." And then apparently runs up and does this great display of the intense kissing of Jesus. So again, think of the kiss as a show-off type thing that lets his venom forth. Don't think of it as the type of thing that the Roman soldier said, "Oh, there he is. Now we know him." Not needed at all. The kiss of betrayal was afterthought as far as the narrative is concerned. And again, remember we said throughout this particular week in the life of Jesus how many times Jesus is in control and the plan goes exactly his way? The plan was I will kiss him. You will then know who he is. And the Lord messes up their plan. Comes out and said, "Who are you looking for?" "Jesus of Nazareth, I am he." And everything. So notice things are going his way, not their way. Okay, back to Luke. Okay, we move then out of that verse now to the second element, and that is the sword. The kiss, and now the sword. And several things that the Lord has to say about that. The sword, 49 through 51. And here with the use of the sword, you've got two kinds of people. You've got those who ask first, and those who acted first. Those who asked first. And then you have one, not those, who acted first. Does anyone have any idea who might belong in each group? As you would expect it. Peter always acted, then thought. Peter has lots of successors that go into action and think later, and that is typically Peter. But notice coming down to verse 49. And when those who were around him saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? In other words, do you want us to go into battle? And then, of course, one who did not ask first, but acted first, is in verse 50. A certain one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. And again, as we had previously, apparently Malchus ducked. Peter certainly went for the head. He ducked, and his ear got cut off. And Jesus answered and said, stop, no more of this. And he touched his ear and healed him. So the sword comes into the picture. What do you think might have given the disciples courage to go into battle? If I had been with them, and there had only been three of us, and there was a detachment of 600 soldiers, I would have gone into battle too. I really would. You say, well, you're stupid. No, not really. Something had just happened to those Roman soldiers that put me on the right team. You know what it was? Go over to John chapter 18. John chapter 18. Very unusual thing happened that night, and I wouldn't mind being teamed up with this man at all, even if there were only two of us. And I imagine this is what precipitated the courage. Okay, coming down to chapter 18, verse 5. When they asked who he was, verse 5, he answered them, Jesus the Nazarene. And he said to them, I am. And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. When therefore he said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. Would you want to be on his team? I mean, you just stand right in there, and here comes the detachment of 600 soldiers, and he says, zip. The Lord had nuked them already. And so that probably explains not so much the courage, but why they were ready to go into battle. If the Lord can nuke them like that, which we've already seen, then shall we go ahead and join you and wipe the whole crew out? And the Lord obviously says, stop, no more of this, it is over. That moves in then to verse 52, which is the encounter. And the encounter is 52-53. And the Lord is going to say three things. Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and the elders who'd come against him, have you come out with swords and clubs as against a robber? While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this hour and the power of darkness are yours. Three things about the act. Number one, the act was unnecessary. You don't need all of this equipment and all of these soldiers to do the job. Two, the act was unjust. You treat me as though I were a robber. And third, it was so very close to the first one, but it was totally uncalled for. They could not justify it in any way. With that then, verse 54, our next transition, having arrested him, they led him away. Now let's, and we're doing successfully tonight, 25 till, let's start with some observations. Mine first. Pardon? Oh, sure.
Was there something procedural in the betrayal, accusatory or something? Because the priest knew who he was, and it says
It
wasn't identification.
No. The whole, in other words, it wasn't a matter of, and that's a good question. Do you think that these people in the Sanhedrin couldn't identify Jesus? Several things do come into it. There could have been an identification problem because it was night. And you got to keep in mind, there were no street lights in Jerusalem. And therefore, anybody, like back in a garden, you would not know who was there. That wouldn't be possible. for that to be the case. In other words, your ability to identify people. And I don't know, it's so hard for us to know what it's like for lights to be out, because lights are never out with us. But I would imagine if we... I wouldn't drive down the freeway, would you? With no lights on the car or anywhere else. You'd certainly be hitting things. I would like to be able to identify the semi in front of me, which I couldn't do. So, and I think it's a minor factor, but that is a factor there, is the identification would be hard because of the night. It would also be hard because Jesus was back in the olive garden. So you have the massive trees in Gethsemane. So among the trees back there, there could have been somewhat of a problem of identification. The other factor I think would come into it would be speed. They didn't have time to go hustling through and try to say, is Jesus over here? And look around until they saw his face and recognized. This had to be quick, remember. Because he had to be picked out. We got to get him crucified out of the way by sunup. And so I think that factor comes in. There's also, because of the nature of the kiss being affection, friendship, that type of thing, apparently a desire to make the whole thing ugly and to be vitriolic in what was done. So that factor enters it too. I'd put just those things together as a combination. That's a good question, though. And the Lord emphasized, I've been daily with you in the temple, which is saying, you know me. Why didn't you do it then? But procedure, there was no procedure involved in that, at least that I'm aware of. Mm-mm. Apparently just a vitriolic, we really want to... Judas apparently wanted to betray him, and he wanted to betray him bad. He wanted to earn his 30 pieces of silver. And I think that would account for the passionate kiss and all of the and the repeated type thing. Okay, observation. Now remember, observation is what you see, not what you imagine, not what you would like to be there or hope to be there or imagine to be there. What is really there? The restoration of Malchus' ear. The restoration of Malchus' ear. Was. You know what we're going to say? The last act of Jesus' hand before he gets handcuffed. This was the last act before he was handcuffed. Or as I believe it's John says, he was arrested and bound, because it is at the point in verse 54 from the other narratives that arresting Jesus was binding him, he was tied. And so the last act that he ever did was to heal Malchus, put the ear back on, and from there on his hands are bound. The last act. That says a lot, really, if you think about it, doesn't it? A benevolent, kind act was the last thing he did before he was treated with the utmost unkindness. So it shows where his final chapter is. As they slap the handcuffs on, he puts the ear on. Second, the strength received in Gethsemane. And remember, that was in the fact that the angel was there and strengthened him. And we noted that was strengthened bodily. The strength received in Gethsemane, is sufficient, we will find, for the rest of the suffering. We'll just put sufficient for the trials to follow. There is no repetition of any other angel come back and strengthen him again. So what happened in the garden was good enough, and it is followed. Third, and I think this has got to be classic. Peter is the perfect example of misguided zeal for Christ. Peter is the perfect example of misguided zeal for Christ, emphasis, for the Lord. That is a good, good lesson. Because don't we see a lot of that out there today? People, even Christians, breaking the law in the name of saving a life. And the cause is great. But there is such a thing of Peter, for crying out loud, put your sword away. This is not a physical battle. No, this is not a physical battle. Put your sword up and stop. And granted, Peter's heart had to be as good as gold, I would think. You know, I'll fight for him. I'll kill for him. I'll do anything in the world that I can do for him. I'll stand up for truth. I'm on his side. But Peter, watch your zeal. The way you do it is very, very important. And we need to note that today, because I think you have many among believers who do love truth, who do appreciate the Lord, but their zeal can get very stupid. I think it hasn't continued, but I just can almost read, because Christians do such crazy things today. Last Wednesday, before class, we got a fax that said, "Do you know what love is?" And after class, we got a second one. And it says, had John 3:16. I know what love is. It is this, John 3:16. And I told Janie, I say, "You know, some idiot out there has started a fax ministry. You know, plaguing everybody with his zeal and faxing everybody things like that." And what is the typical unbeliever response? You laugh at it, don't you? You mock it. That's the same concept, putting pearls before swine. And we have to watch that today, because you've got a lot of zeal out there that's really, really, really crazy. I think you could probably start an organization and get money from Christians to march on the veterinarians in town who don't have proper sympathy for pregnant, unwed cats. You could probably raise a cause on that, and that we need to watch. I'm exaggerating, but we need to watch that. And Peter's an excellent example of it. He loved the Lord. He was for the Lord. He would fight for the Lord. He'd take the sword up for the Lord. He'd shed blood for the Lord. But the Lord says, none of that. And that, of course, we know is because the battle is not physical, spiritual. That's where we do warfare. Okay. And we want these to be voluntary observations, things you saw. You do not have to participate if you want. But if you've seen something here that I have not listed and want to list it, again, this is voluntary. Dave Collins. I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. That was my observation. I won't write it. Okay, anything you saw in the lesson tonight? All right, Lee?
Jesus' touch
had power. All right, Jesus' touch. Had power. Let's work on that just a moment. Jesus' touch obviously here had power. But was that touch the limitation of his power? Did he have to touch? And if he could have done it without a touch, he chose not to, obviously. Could he have done it without a touch? Could he have thought the ear back on? The answer has got to be emphatically yes, but can you give me a proof? Expand outside this passage now. Think through the miracles of Jesus. Did he ever perform a miracle without a touch? Can you think of one where there was no prayer, no touch, just will? How about the very first one? Water to wine. Nothing was touched. It was will. So Jesus touch, let's put it this way, and polish a little bit. Jesus touch, how about this? Reveal his power. Nothing wrong with Hattie's pad power. Okay, we're just trying to sharpen it up a little bit. Okay? I'm doing a Charles Ryrie now. That's what I always used to do in school. And say, okay, that's true, but the sentence is too long. Shorten it. You're not quite focused. Focus it. Until you learn to detest, and then pretty soon you'll begin to learn the importance of precise statement and so forth. Okay? Yeah, Dan. It must be
like an unusual response for a robot before works, would do that in response.
I think it has to be treated as a miracle. I don't know any other way. Some put some fact that notice this is I am He, and that is the Greek counterpart to Yahweh, the I am of the Old Testament. And therefore it could have been that a peculiar power was involved in the very fact I am. And as he spoke the name for Yahweh, the name that belongs only to God in the Old Testament, there was a power connected with it. But I think, rather than look at the miracle, doesn't this illustrate John... you help me. Doesn't it illustrate, no man takes my life from me, I give it. I give my life, no man takes it from me. I know that's in John. Does anyone... Is it John 10? Okay, there we go. 17, for this reason the Father, my Father loves me. Remember, this was the upper room discourse. It was spoken to them that night. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I might take it again. No one has taken it away from me. I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I receive from the Father. I'll make this general, but it calls to mind another observation from what Dan just said. The events of the evening show the voluntary nature of his death. Events of the evening show the voluntary nature of his death. Okay, now what can we think of that will support that? And by the way, you should not buy that. You really shouldn't buy that. Because I have given you no evidence. So, before you buy it, let me give you some. Judas was going to kiss him in order to betray him and deliver him. Instead, Jesus stepped forth and said, "Here I am." What is that saying? I was not betrayed by the kiss. I voluntarily stepped forth and gave myself. What Dan just mentioned. Is Rome going to wallow him to the ground? Well, just as a preface, as the soldiers stand there, he says, "I am," and they apparently, by the power of the statement, are thrown backward. Who's in control? The Roman soldiers or Jesus? I think that's probably what the thrust of it is. Brings out those things. Yeah, Bob.
I think it goes back further than that, Dennis. At the end of the Last Supper, he knew what was going to happen. He instructed Jesus to go ahead and betray him.
Sure. Whatever you're going to do, get up and do it now, quickly.
The other thing is, my observation of this whole incident is, number one, this wasn't a fly-by-night thing. This was an operation. This was already planned out ahead of time. I think you mentioned in one of your previous studies that it was a habit of Jesus to go to the garden and pray. in the evening. And so consequently, Judas was knowing from habit that this is what he did, that this is where he was going to find him. And everything is lined up for this because of the Holy Days coming, and he had no one to give him to put him to death before the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast.
Passover, yeah. And there you allude to another thing that shows he's in control. And you allude to it, and I just forgot it. What was it? It shows... You just said it. Oh, he chose the normal place to go when he could have gone elsewhere. Yeah. And I think that thread, I think it's fair to say that is a theme that goes throughout this context. Okay, Dave, have you said anything yet? Yes, Nancy.
It seems interesting to me that Peter takes off this guy's ear and just a few verses later he's denying the Lord. We know that it was prophesied and all that. Is it just the fact that the Lord is not present with him?
Well, okay, the observation is that here Peter's ready to cut off the ear, which showed courage, and he takes out his sword, and yet a little bit later, he faces the little girl. He says, aren't you one of them? He denies the Lord. How does that fit together? I think it may say this, that very often our strength is our weakness. Peter's strong point was his courage. Where did he fall on his face? That's a good observation. Just a minute. Peter's strength. Peter's strength was his weakness. And I think it's fair to say that his strength was his courage. But it's also where he fell on his face. I don't know whether that pans out in life or not. Have any of us fallen on our strong points? Only to find out where we were strong, we were really weak? Could be. Okay, Dave? Okay. Respect for Jesus was shown by the large arresting group. What else is going to happen that is going to support that point also? Can you think of something else? He had talked about this 3 days, and because of his talk, after he died, what did they do? That was a reason for all the security. They put all the Roman security. So even Rome said, yeah, we'll give you all the security we can give. And what did that branch from? Those words that he had spoken. That just might be true. Okay. Yeah, Bob.
Just make note of the fact that when he was just these 3 days, when he was in the temple and turned over the money changers and the temple police and all of the Sanhedrin and everybody else were playing riled with him. And they were laid hands on him then, but he passed through them for one his time, he says. He passed through, but here in the 53rd verse, he says, this is your hour.
Yeah. That's a good point, and we went over that lightly, did we not? This is your hour. What's he saying? I'm in control. It's your hour, but I'll tell you what that hour will be. That's a good point. Marilyn? That's an interesting parallel. It's certainly true, isn't it? Her observation was that Adam was in the garden when tempted by Satan. likewise Jesus. That's an interesting point. Remember, we have the... I almost have to do it in loyalty to an old professor, S. Lewis Johnson, who just would become furious when you talked about the first Adam and the second Adam. He says there is no second Adam. It's the first Adam and the last Adam. We always say if there was a second Adam, there could have been a third and a fourth. But if there's a last Adam, that's it. And since Christ was the last Adam, and that's an interesting point, he is not the second but the last. Okay? Gene. Yes. There you go. Okay, that's a good. Jesus was user friendly. Yeah. Now, this is not observation, but it is an interesting thought. I wonder if any of the Roman soldiers came to believe in him that night. Yeah, one did. Remember? The centurion that was at the cross observed how he died and came to believe. You wonder, as some of these soldiers picked themselves up from the dirt, if someone might not have said, I believe. I don't know. That's not an observation. That's just guesswork. Yeah, Alice?
Is this the first time Jesus was ever under somebody else's control or at least visibly? And I was wondering if that might be what shocked Peter, that he was going to deal with the king being arrested.
Yeah. The only I'm sure that was the case, but the only problem there is, just remember the sequence, is that the meeting of the group and the betrayal was followed by his being bound. It was not until they removed him from the garden. When they moved him from the garden off to Annas, then they handcuffed him. So standing in the garden, he was free at that point. He was not under arrest at that point. So he carries on conversation, he's identified, he talks with them, and then it's only as they leave the garden that they, for the first time, restrict his movement.
Well, I agree with Matthew. I've had a lot of time seeing why Peter changed so drastically. I don't understand
that. Well, I don't know, give an absolute answer to that, except to say, what do we say about Peter? This man was probably the most impulsive a person around. Very frankly, having been a pastor for 32 years, I find it no surprise. I've seen sheep do that like you wouldn't believe. If someone is there, they're taking those, taking it in, going like mad and zip. Where did you go? Oh, we belong to All Souls Unitarian Church now. So that's not too unusual to me.
You know, we throw this word, I believe, around pretty loose. I mean, you talk about the Roman soldier who believed, what did you believe? Did you believe that he was his son? That was the extent of what the belief was. And just like the chief priest, he believed that Jesus was the Messiah also.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us that in Scripture. But that still doesn't mean anything as far as from eternity is concerned.
Yeah. And they probably believed him to be the Messiah from the perspective they had, without any saving work involved in it, or any concept of any saving work of a Messiah. Yeah. Okay, these are good. It makes you interact and think on Scripture and observe things. And that takes practice. The more you practice, the better you get at it. You get to the point that I am after these many years. I even see things that are not there. Watch that also. Father, we're thankful tonight for your truth and your word in Christ's name. Amen.